Can we do a practice of what order we're going to say our names in?
Are we doing it alphabetical by first name?
Yes.
Somebody emailed us to tell us that order recently.
Yes. I'm Andrew.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm me.
There is only one Mike Saunders.
There is only one. Fantastic. There can be only one. which is why Mike moved away to Germany to stop us from chopping his head off and collecting his special powers. Anyway, this is Linux Voice. As you've already heard, I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
Fantastic. And in this fun-packed podcast, we struggle with the alphabet once more. We have news. We have a vocalizer on neurons. We have discoveries or finds. And we have the voice of the masses. If you like the sound of this, but would rather have it in a paper format or electron format, for those of you who like PDFs or EPUBs, you can subscribe to Linux Voice, the magazine, at shop.linuxvoice.com.
And issue 16 goes on sale today.
It does. Fantastic. So we move to our West Country correspondent, Ben Everard, with the news.
Hello, and welcome to the West Country. Right, in non-West Country related news, SourceForge are being bad people. Ooh, boo, SourceForge.
Haven't we hinted at this, at them being bad people for months now? Whenever I have to download FileZilla on Windows.
Oh, it's horrid, isn't it? Yeah, I had the same with XChat or HexChat, whichever it is on Windows, I forget.
It's disgraceful. Terrible. Disgraceful.
It's such a shame because for so long, SourceForge was a beacon. It was the place to get free software. It was the only place. And they provided all these resources for software developers, mailing lists, wikis, all that sort of good stuff.
It's where it's still the official repository for KAlbum.
Is it?
I wonder how many people have downloaded it this week. Let me check.
Hang on, what has SourceForge done wrong?
What they've done wrong is they blocked the lead developer of GIMP for Windows out of his account and inserted a load of adverts into the software.
Into the software?
Into the actual software. So when you downloaded GIMP for Windows, you got GIMP for Windows plus adverts. So this doesn't affect Windows users, so if you're
Linux users.
This doesn't affect Linux users. If you're a regular Linux user, just get it from your repositories as you've always done and you'll be fine. If you need to install it on Windows, go to the GIMP homepage and get it from there rather than from SourceForge and you'll get the right version.
I mean, you wonder where this could end. Somebody made a comment on some website that they could start introducing adverts into source code as well. So if you download the source code for a program, you see a nice comment and it says, drink Coca-Cola or something.
That's actually quite common in HTML source code. You'll see it sort of going through in various bits, adverts for developers.
Really?
Yeah, if you look in JavaScript and HTML files being served by web pages, you'll often see, not often, but occasionally see,
Right, because they know that developers will be poking around inside there.
If you're poking around inside a JavaScript file, you're probably the sort of person that Google or someone like that may wish to hire.
Mm.
But this is disgraceful.
It is.
Isn't SourceForge owned by Slashdot or some affiliation?
It's DICE Holdings, yeah. SourceForge has been battered around through various companies over the years. I mean, I still host MicOS on there. I used to host it on Berlioz, a German thing, for a while, but they shut down. Now I'm thinking about maybe moving to GitHub or something. I don't really need all these features of GitHub.
But the one thing SourceForge has that no one else, I think, has is binary hosting. SourceForge is great for source code, but they won't host your binary files.
GitHub, do you mean?
Yeah, GitHub, sorry, won't host binary files.
Yeah, it is more difficult, isn't it? I think there's some way you can get a zip file onto GitHub, but that's probably normally just a collection of the source code, isn't it? So,
yeah, I believe it's against their terms of service to store binary files on there.
Really?
Yeah.
That doesn't leave many things left then. There's like non-GNU, isn't there? Or GNU Savannah and a few other hosting providers. But
I'm not sure Savannah does binary hosting either.
Really?
I think it's only SourceForge, which is why projects still use it.
Yeah.
And why, I mean, it's annoying for Linux users, but for the most part, it's not the end of the world because you rarely need binary files from anyone other than your distribution. But yeah, for Windows users or to a lesser extent OS X users, it's a problem because Windows doesn't have a decent package manager.
Yep.
Let's move on to something a little bit more Linux related. That's our Microsoft news over. Ubuntu and Kubuntu have been getting in disagreements. The Ubuntu Community Council says it no longer recognises the authority of Jonathan... Is it Riddle? Riddell?
Yeah, I think it's Riddell, yeah.
Riddell, who is the leader of the Kubuntu community. The Kubuntu Council said they support Jonathan Riddell. The most concerning thing about this for me, I mean, obviously you're always going to get disagreements within projects and things are always going to happen, but this has all happened behind the scenes. No one really knows what it's about. There's sort of rumours that it might be to do with binary licensing or the handling of funds that were donated to Canonical with the intention of supporting support for more flavours. But this is just speculation based on disagreements Jonathan's had with people within the Ubuntu community. So we don't know what's caused it.
Yeah, I mean, the reasoning from the Ubuntu Council is that Jonathan Riddle had been like too aggressive with people and stuff. But I went through lots of like IRC logs and mailing lists and things and didn't really see any evidence of that. I saw him trying to get information from Canonical about certain legal issues and Canonical spending ages to answer them. So, you know, he was a bit frustrated with that. But the fact that the Kubuntu Council, because he is like the head of the Kubuntu project, the fact that they've said, no, you know, we want him to stay, that's the quite disturbing thing, that Ubuntu seems to be overriding or trying to override what Kubuntu does.
Well, so Jonathan's done this for an awful long time. In some periods of Kubuntu's history, he seems to have done it almost single-handedly. He's been through kind of a big personal journey as well in doing all of this. And there have been examples in the past where there's been conflict between the two parties and Canonical and Jonathan's relationship within the community. And this just seems like the wrong way to do something like this. And ineffective. I don't think it's going to... What are they going to do as an alternative? And they don't seem to even understand their own powers when people on the Kubuntu committee are elected anyway.
Yeah, and it's this weird term. They no longer respect the authority. Yeah. Well, what does that mean?
It sounds incredibly inflammatory. And couldn't this have been done in private? And I don't know. It sounds like a typical kind of PR disaster for Canonical, really.
I mean, I'm assuming a lot has gone on in private. This isn't just the first time. Yeah, it's all going along, and then suddenly they've just said, oh, this is wrong.
I think we all know over the years there's been a lot of stuff going on in private with Kubuntu and Jonathan and the way that the whole thing's managed. A lot of people don't talk about it, but there has. But this is still the wrong way for something. I just don't know how this is going to help anybody. It's not going to help Canonical. It's not going to help Kubuntu.
No.
I hope it survives.
It can't not survive. It's probably the biggest flavor of Ubuntu outside the main one.
So maybe it'll fork. I mean, maybe that's what it's about, the brand name Kubuntu, who owns it.
Yeah, I mean, it is a slightly weird one because Kubuntu is not supported by Canonical, but it is supported by Blue Systems, who employ Jonathan Riddell, I believe, or sponsor him at least.
Yeah. It's a big story for KDE users because it's probably the best go-to KDE distribution to use.
So more Linux distro news. Fedora 22 is released. I went on to the Fedora announcement on Fedora Magazine and they listed all the new features, almost all of which were just the newest features of GNOME.
Yeah.
So, like, look, Fedora's got new notifications. No, those are GNOME notifications.
They do hire many of the GNOME developers, though.
Yeah. But, yeah, so as far as I can tell, if you're not using GNOME, the new features are the Software Center, which may also be only GNOME. I haven't actually installed a different desktop to try it out. But,
and DNF is the new package manager, isn't it?
That is true. Yeah. They've switched to DNF.
Replacing Yum, supposed to be faster and better and shinier.
That is quite significant, isn't it, after all these years?
It works. It's broadly the same as Yum, isn't it? You use it in the same basic way.
So yeah. It uses deltas, doesn't it? It uses differences in packages rather than downloading whole packages.
Really, that's very welcome. Because especially when I think of like my Arch installation, which managed to break itself, of course. I didn't read the wiki clearly. Every time I go and update Arch, like every week or 2 weeks, it downloads a new version of the Oxygen icon set for KDE, which is like 150 megabytes. And I assume very little has actually changed. And a Delta update that only downloads the bytes that have changed would be very, very welcome.
The thing that always annoys me about Yum, and this annoys me more than it should really, is that the package searching is online. So in apt-get, you search your local store of packages and you can update them, etc. On Yum, it always searches them on the online version. And there was this, when you do the search, there's waiting in queue. And I don't know why. It never takes more than a few seconds, but it frustrates me so much. It's like, I want to search my packages, don't put me in a queue, damn it.
Yeah.
That's a UI problem, really. What they need to do is not say waiting in queue. They need to show that they're doing 1,000 things a second. So you think, wow, this is fast.
Yeah. Well, if it just says something like loading database, I'd be like, okay, it's loading the database.
Loading 2 billion database entries and a number that goes up.
Yeah. Oh, so many entries. It must be good. So it's also got the new GNOME builder that was crowdfunded.
The IDE.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, we should look at that.
Yeah. So let's move on to some online Linux news or open source news. OnlyOffice, a web-based word processor, sort of Google Docs alike type thing, has been open sourced. So this is something, I believe there is a version online that you can use to sort of try out for sort of personal use. But you can host it yourself and run your own Google Docs without having to hand all your data over to advertising companies.
I wonder if this would be something good to merge with OwnCloud. OwnCloud's got its own sort of document editor built in. I haven't used it for a while, so I don't know how powerful it is now. But a whole sort of suite of file sharing, storage, and document editing would be great.
OwnCloud One is getting better. It's a lot better in the latest version than in when it first came out, but it's still a bit hit or miss. It doesn't have particularly good support for complex formatting, and it just went a bit strange sometimes. But what perhaps a better way of doing this is the way it's done. You can use WebDAV storage. So basically you can link it to an OwnCloud instance. So provided you have your username and password, that can be any OwnCloud instance that you have an account on. So rather than integrating sort of into the same package, you can host them separately, you can host them in different organizations. You can pay someone to host OwnCloud and host OnlyOffice yourself or whichever way you want.
I think it's great because, I mean, whenever this comes up, it's the same with the LibreOffice, which is getting very close to release, I notice. I get excited because I used to use Google Docs and stopped using it. I liked having pervasive, good, decent editor, basically, that is more advanced than the OwnCloud one. So I'm still looking for the perfect cloud editing that I can self-host.
Yeah, I've gone through a few different phases. I used OwnCloud Docs for a while, and it's getting there. I mean, it's developing. It might be there soon, but it's just not stable enough. It was locking me out of documents. It was losing edits. It was.
I like the minimalism of Google Docs. It actually looks good. You know, it could take up the full window of my browser, and the font rendering was really good, and the word count was just a single shortcut away.
Yeah, the one I'm quite interested in is in Etherpad.
All right.
Which is just a text editor, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
But works in a similar way. You can have multiple people editing it, or obviously edit it from different devices. But it's just a bit of a pain to set up with any form of security. It's just a text editor that you can sort of... It's not really designed to be, you know, password protected or anything like that. It can be done, but it's a bit awkward. Let's have a look on the big list of news. Ooh, let's switch back to Linux distro news with Mandriva. The company that started in 1998 and has been providing Linux desktops for 17 years has gone into liquidation.
Nobody saw this coming, did they?
Yeah, the writing's been on the wall for a while. I mean, we don't have the latest financial information, but in 2003, they generated half a million euros. So yeah, 2013, they generated half a million euros in revenue.
Doesn't seem like much.
Well, it's not that little either.
How many employees?
I imagine, yeah, exactly, that's what I was going to say.
I mean, that's enough to cover server hosting and a few developers. That'll keep you cracking along.
Yeah, it is the end of the road for an interesting distro. I mean, the distro has been split off into OpenMandriva and Mageia or Mageia, or however you pronounce it.
Which is due a major release, isn't it, in the near future?
Yeah, exactly. I think all of us have memories of installing Mandrake back in the day. I think I got a bot set of Mandrake 7.1 when it was primarily made in France, and yeah, it was basically Red Hat but with a shiny KDE desktop and more
UR
polish.
PMI. The package manager was great.
Yep.
It also had the sort of single tool for configuring your desktop, so if you didn't know all the various commands, it was all just there.
Yeah, Mandriva Control Center was like the competition to Yast, a big central tool for doing all administration.
The installer was good as well.
Oh yeah, it had one of the first graphical installers.
And it's, you know, probably why I ended up being a KDE user for so long, because you know those early distros were based on KDE. I can remember it fondly. But they lost me. They got rid of Gael Duval, the founder. You know, in a pretty awful circumstances. And I've never really understood the motivation or the business model behind the company since then, really. Mm. And Gael's doing, I think he's doing really well with.
Ultio.
It runs a new web browser.
That's right. I think now my memory is getting clearer. I think Gael has left after the IPO. So whatever the terms were, they were very good for him. And the company's doing. The company and the technology is being used in lots and lots of places. Yeah, it's a virtual desktop through a web browser.
And our final item on our list of news this fortnight is the Venom security bug. This is a security vulnerability in KVM's floppy disk, or virtual floppy disk controller. So KVM is a technology used for virtualization to run virtual machines on your computers. It can be used on desktop, but it's probably mostly used in servers where they host lots of virtual servers on a single physical server. And this particular vulnerability allows malicious code running in a virtual machine to access the host machine. So if you're running a data center, if you're running a data center using KVM, you really should have heard about this already. If you haven't, start panicking now. it shouldn't really affect general users too much because, as I say, KVM's not used that much on the desktop, and when it is, it's not really used to host malicious code.
Hang on, did you say it's in the virtual floppy drive controller?
Yes, it is.
I'm not really sure why that would be enabled anyway.
I think it's used for sort of... Well, it's one of those things that's just there because it's there and no one feels the need to take it out. But I believe it's sometimes used for sort of updates and that sort of thing. It's a bit of a hack that's sometimes used for bits and pieces.
Yeah, I mean, apart from MicOS stuff, I can't recall the last time I've used an emulated floppy drive in any way. So. But like you say, it's probably just some legacy code that's there. They found no reason to remove it.
Yeah, and if the if the code for it's there, then an OS or some code running in a virtual machine could trigger it.
Right, it's time to move on from floppies then, officially.
But does macOS boot without floppy controllers?
You can boot macOS from a USB key.
But I thought it had an emulated floppy disk on the USB.
It does, but that's the emulation is done in the BIOS, so you don't think you need a floppy controller then.
But no, isn't this the KVM's equivalent of the BIOS floppy controller?
Oh, I see. Well, I'm not sure about it in this case. But yeah, it looks like the writing on the wall is on the wall for macOS in KVM then. All those data centers running thousands of instances of macOS at the same time. You know, they'll have to move on to FreeDOS or something else.
The world of banking will fall apart. And that's the news this fortnight.
Great, thanks, Ben. That takes us on to finds of the fortnight. I asked the IRC channel before we started the recording, and there's been a few. In particular, Twisted Lucidity mentions Wallabag.org. This is an open source equivalent or alternative to Pocket. Pocket's come up a few times before, and I think it came up even in our last podcast where Firefox, Mozilla has put in the proprietary hooks to enable Pocket integration in Firefox. So Wallabag is an open source equivalent Pocket, for those of you who don't know. It's like it's like bookmarks for websites, but it allows you to download the articles that you tag for offline reading and synchronization across other devices logged into your Pocket account. I use it. I use it for stuff that I don't have the time to read. I use Pocket. So the fact that there's an open source alternative that I can host again on my VPN is really good.
I was going to say, so this requires some server software.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
But the server software is open source.
That's right. It's all open source. And I believe it looks like they can host your, if you want to trust them, you can host your stuff at their site as well.
I used to find Pocket really useful when I commuted on the train, because when you're during the day, you can just click on stuff and say send to Pocket and it will automatically download and cache it.
Yeah.
On your phone, so on the train, when it didn't have an internet connection.
But does it download entire web pages with all the furniture around?
It sort of reformats them, or Pocket does. I don't know what
Wallabang. Yeah, I haven't used it either. I haven't used Wallabang either, yeah, but...
It sort of reformats it and strips out all the sort of adverts and sort of stuff around the page and gets the actual text of the article and... Some, I think it has the pictures as well, or maybe that was a setting. I can't quite remember.
It's like the readability add-on, isn't it? It kind of makes it... I think, for example, you can get Pocket for Kindle and stuff like that, so it makes long-form text off the internet really easy to read.
That sounds very good.
Yeah. I never had any problems with it picking up the wrong bits of text, but I suppose it's a potential issue.
So another find by James Olympus, I don't know if I pronounced that right because there's some numeric characters. It's this huge link LD command that basically turns a PNG file into something he can use within his SDL application and include within his C code. I'll include the command. He says LD will name the string based on the file name. It's complicated, and it's only going to be helpful for specific SDLC programmers, I suspect, but it looks neat, and he's proud of it.
So it's an LD command.
Yes, it's using LD. Yeah, this is why I think he's pleased with it, to create an object file out of a PNG file that he can then use within his own source code without specifically loading the PNG file.
Okay.
VirtualBox Beta 5.004. And that's it, I think. James Olympus then goes on to say that the nm command is very good for listing symbols within object files. Wow. In terms of my finds, I haven't got anything specific, but I got out my old wrist PDA watch from like 10 years ago. I'm wearing it. There it is. There it is. It's this huge. It's this huge monolithic thing.
It's smaller than I thought it'd be, actually.
And I've started to wear it. It's really useful.
It's the Fossil PDA, isn't it?
That's right. It's running Palm OS 4.1 or something.
It looks very much like a shrunken Palm Pilot. I was lucky enough to watch Graham play around with this in a pub many years ago. You got like SimCity and some games running on it, didn't you?
It runs anything. It runs any Palm file from Palm OS 4, so you can just run anything on it.
Is it multitasking?
To an extent, as much as Palm is, you can do some things in the background, and it runs specific watch apps at the front that were made for the watch. The problem with the device in the old days was battery life, because you had to charge it every day, and until smartwatches solve that problem, I just don't want to. I can't imagine how useful they'd be. However, with this. You can buy the iPod Shuffle had a battery that fits into this watch, like a 3.7 volt Lion, and I bought one off eBay last week for $2.99 from the Netherlands, and I've had like a week's battery life out of it. It's really cool.
That is awesome. Are you actually using it for any practical stuff then, or is it just more geek interest?
I'm just using it as a watch, and it's got like a calendar on it, and the my link to my Find. Most of the Palm Pilot synchronization apps are no longer developed or supported. JPilot is perhaps the only exception. But the KDE tool used to be called KPilot, and it's synchronized with Google Calendar, which is actually really helpful. And I haven't been able to get KPilot running because it's unsupported and the libraries have all moved on. It's actually really difficult, so you can't build it. So I've ended up having to download old versions of Kubuntu, like from 2009, where KPilot was still being developed and people still had Palm devices. And even then, it's difficult because you're relying on those deb files being hosted on the repository still. It's not part of the main distribution. And it's going to become an increasingly difficult problem to solve, as you know, in terms of software becoming obsolete and hardware that relies on specific software. And that's kind of my find. I've not come up against it before.
It is one of those areas where Linux often sucks, is backward compatibility,
Maybe we should take a complete backup of all the repositories for like 1204. Keep them, and in 10 years we'll be like, oh, we can still support
Palm.
I don't know.
They're a Palm, but I mean, considering it's really useful, it's great. And you can get into the apps and make notes, and the interface got a touch screen. And if anybody remembers the Palm gesture control for typing, it's quite intuitive.
So you can probably do way more with that than you can do with an Apple Watch.
Oh, with more than an Apple Watch, I'd say. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
You can do anything you can do on your old Palm.
Does it have Wi-Fi, or does it predate that?
No, unfortunately, it's got infrared.
Does that mean you have to find like a 10-year-old phone and strap it to your wrist like 3 inches further up your arm?
If I go into a pub and then go like 3 inches from the television playing the sport, I might be able to get an app that changes the channel. It's got a USB port. It's got a great big USB port on the side. But also the nice thing about it is that the, I think they were from 2003, 2004, or the plastic strap had decayed. So too is the cover over the USB port, cheap plastic. But it's standard, you know, strap sizes, which unlike the Apple Watch. So it just goes to show you that if you do spend $13,500 on an Apple Watch, you might be stuffed in 10 years, but not with a Palm Watch.
No, although I will point out that I did look these up on eBay the other day when Graham was mentioning them on IRC, these Palm Fossil watches, and they do go for about £200 now. I think they're sort of collector's items.
Which is amazing, because it cost me about £30.
Yeah.
So does that mean they're more expensive now than the low-end iWatch? Yeah, how much is an iWatch?
I think they're about £250. I think. I don't know. I haven't really been that interested in buying into the Apple Watch.
Fair enough.
Not having an iPhone.
Have you got your like Sony Walkman to go with it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Try and find one of those briefcase-sized laptop computers.
I used to have a binary watch face on it, but I've not got that far yet. I might put it on. That's my kind of find. Does anyone else want to have a go? Has anyone sent you one, Mike?
No. But I have a sort of find that there's also a public service announcement, and that is do not donate to the GIMP. At least if you want to donate to the GIMP, because it is an awesome piece of software, do a lot of research first. As part of our profit donation scheme, as most of our listeners will know, we were to give £300 to the GIMP project. So when this happened, I went to the GIMP's website, went to donate, read the instructions, transfer the money to this bank account and email this account. I followed it all to the letter. Nothing happened. 3 days later, we got a payment to our bank account from some random bank in America for £300. It looked like it'd come back. The bank account was actually owned by the GNOME Foundation. GIMP was doing its donations through the GNOME Foundation. So I contacted GNOME Foundation. They're trying to look into it. They've been helpful, but I've been getting emails from all sorts of different people. The whole thing has turned into a massive mess. Okay, we can all make mistakes, and I don't mean to be really bitchy, but come on, GIMP guys. You know, you're one of the biggest open source projects. You know,
lacks funding, lacks developers,
and yet, and there's the GNOME Foundation said, we have long since closed the account that the GIMP recommends on its webpage, and we've contacted the GIMP to tell them to change it. So it's just all sorts of sloppiness everywhere here, and it's quite frustrating, really. You know, we want this money to be in the hands of GIMP developers, but if they're not even going to put effort into getting donations themselves. If anybody else does want to donate to GIMP, then just try and speak to them, the lead developers, first.
The payment instructions, they weren't hosted on SourceForge.
Yeah, as soon as I donated, I got this Ask toolbar installed on my Internet Explorer.
I mean, there's two sad things about that story, really. One is that GIMP makes it hard to donate them. The other is they're obviously getting so few donations that...
I'm not surprised.
But yeah. So that's been left. I assume that isn't there because every week someone tries to donate money. That's been left there because no one's donated money in that way for a few years.
Quite possibly, or a lot of the donations are small, you know, like $10 or something, and then people don't even notice if it bounces back to them. I mean, there are other ways to donate to GIMP on that page, and some of them might actually work, but it's the fact that the bank transfer one, you know, the one that you want to preferably do when you're moving £300 around is wrong, and has been wrong for a long period of time. And that's my find, courtesy of the GIMP project.
It's a good find.
That's a great find. Well done, Mike.
I have two finds this fortnight. Neither of them are Linux-related, and one is more of just a massive rant than a find. The first is it's an Android game I've been playing called Ingress. It's an augmented reality game from a company that calls themselves a startup within Google. I have no idea what that means. I assume it means it's part of Google that are trying to sound cooler than just saying they're part of Google. But it's a sort of science fiction-y type game, but it's based in the real world. So when you turn it on, you have a map, which is basically Google Maps, but with roads, and the rest is just blacked out, so no buildings or marks or anything else. Except what they call portals. The sort of background of the game is there's some crazy stuff called exotic matter that's everywhere, and there's two factions fighting to control it, the Enlightenment and the Resistance, and you join one of the factions, and the portals are somehow important. I don't really get into the backstory of any game, to be honest. So you have to go to these portals, but obviously they're in real life places, so you don't just click on them, you have to walk to them or get there however you wish. And once you're there, once you're in with certain range, you can get stuff out of the portals, you can try and take control of the portals, you can attack the portal if the enemy faction's taken control of it. And it's not that complex a game, to be honest. So they've made this ridiculously complex backstory that I haven't bothered reading. It's kind of an excuse to get out and have a bit of a walk around. It's like the electronic version of having a dog. And it's what I quite like about it is I work in an office, and I guess like a lot of people, I spend a lot of time sat staring at a computer, and after a certain time I need to get away from my desk, but I don't really have a reason to get away from my desk, and this gives me a reason. Every, you know, maybe a couple of times a day I go for a little So a 15-minute walk around the block, capture a few portals, get back to my desk feeling refreshed and having stretched my legs. And
sounds cool. I want to try it.
It's a bit weird, but I enjoy it.
Do you see anyone else playing the game? Are people hanging around portals ready to push you into oncoming traffic?
Well, actually, just before I met you in Bristol yesterday, we met to interview Corey Doctorow. And I had 15 minutes to kill, so I did a bit of a loop around to hack some portals. And someone else was there. And I was like, I had to look around.
Were they 12?
It was full of school kids. So I was like, this is looking a bit weird, to be honest. I'll just walk away.
It's funny. But you went back and stole the portal off him.
Of course. Yes, my second find this, not even find this fortnight, this is my find today. I'm trying to get tickets for the Rugby World Cup. And can we just, as an internet community, make the decision that putting a load of tickets on sale on a website at a certain point of time is a terrible idea? It never works well, and it's just poor. You know, the websites can't handle loads. They implement these stupid queuing systems, which invariably break for a large portion of the users, which in fairness does reduce demand on the website, but it just leaves you with a lot of frustrated users clicking at a blank screen that doesn't do anything. Ballots work well. You can give people a week. There's no rush. You put your name in the ballot. It's fair. You can limit the numbers of tickets people can apply for, etc., etc. And it just works so much better than this stupid way of having everyone rush to hit F5 or sit in a stupid queue. The reason I'm particularly frustrated about this at the moment is because I joined the queue early and I sat through and I got to the front of the queue, got ready to buy my tickets, and it put me to the back of the queue again. What? So I opened up the web developer toolbox on Firefox, and I don't know exactly what caused it, but it was trying to load some JavaScript, which was trying to load over HTTP on a HTTPS page. So Firefox was blocking that script. It was also throwing jQuery errors. I mean, this is a Rugby World Cup website. This isn't some 2P company throwing something out. They should have this sorted. And I joined in Chrome because I thought, well, maybe it'll work better in Chrome. So that's been running, and it's got all the way down to like a couple of percent from the end, and it was a couple of percent at the end when we started this podcast. I said I might have to duck out and buy the tickets. I'm still in exactly the same position now. I assume it's crashed, but there's big black letters saying if you refresh the page, you'll lose your place in the queue. So all I can do is stare at this broken website wishing I had tickets.
Can you open up Firefox at the same time or a different computer at the same time?
It says don't do this. It says they may well be using some IP level.
Yeah, but there'll be still offices or stuff they'll have to accommodate. And
To be honest, it's too late now. The tickets will have gone because of some stupid JavaScript error. Just do ballots. Ballots work. Ballots are fair.
Ballots don't have premium phone numbers.
Neither does this. There's nothing you can do other than stare at a screen that doesn't work. They don't respond to Twitter. They don't give you any method of communicating with them. But the only thing we can take solace in from this is that at least it's still better than FIFA.
Wow, we've made a football joke. That's like a first. I feel like a proper male.
With your fossil watch.
You might not be able to get tickets, but at least they're not massively corrupt.
Just incompetent.
Yeah, just incompetent.
There's a fine line.
Yeah, it's probably better to be incompetent than corrupt.
Cool, thanks, Ben. Discovered anything, Andrew?
I've only discovered one thing, and that's that Pembroke Castle is the absolute castle to end all castles. It's wonderful. If you ever feel like driving 7 hours to go to a castle, Make sure it's Pembroke Castle that's the one you go to.
I've been to Pembroke twice, actually. And there's things there besides the castle. I went there windsurfing once, and that was quite good. And I went there. They've got an island full of puffins. I was going to say penguins there, but they're like penguins.
Skomer Island.
Quite as cool. Indeed, Skomer Island. And there's a campsite right on the the end near Scone Ride and looking out over the sea, and we were there. It was, you know, there was all the weather warnings out, gales and whatnot, and we had our tent pegged down and tied to boulders, and it was folding in half, and we sat inside with a whole West Country farmhouse cheddar and a stack of wine and just ate that and drank that until the weather calmed down enough to go and see the puffins.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, that does.
Yeah, it's quite a good fun.
Excellent finds. Thanks, everyone.
Now that we're 40-odd minutes into the podcast, it seems like an apt time to have the halfway reminder. It's time for the halfway reminder. Still to come, vocalise your neurons. Maybe, if, I don't know, I'm not sure. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. And the other one, which was, it's the voice of the masses.
Sorry, we can't be halfway through. My Q meter on the Rugby World Cup website says we're still at exactly the same place as when we started.
Bitcoin mining, that's what we need to get into.
So, well, halfway reminded there, Andrew. We have one neuron this episode, which was actually bumped over from last episode because there were so many. And this is from Dizzy Lizzie, who says, I've been running vanilla Debian for 4 years now. I try to avoid proprietary software as much as possible, but there are still some websites that require Flash to work properly. For those sites, I installed Chrome from the .deb provided by Google. I'm big on software freedom, and because of privacy concerns, I'm already hesitant to trust Google, but I noticed something potentially sinister about the contents of Google's Chrome package. It installs a cron job in etc/cron.daily that every day makes sure that the Google Chrome apt repository is in your apt sources. If you manually disable or remove it, it will add it back in. The script also adds the Google sign-in key to your apt key list. As is necessary to perform these tasks, the script runs as root. Google is essentially getting root access to my system and the system of anyone else who installs Chrome from their package. Now, I can understand wanting to ensure that users keep your software up to date, especially where security is vital, but this is a step too far. Not only does it hinder easy control of the software on my system, but it also puts an enormous amount of trust in Google. I've written a cron script of my own that runs a diff on yesterday's Chrome cron job and today's, and emails me if there are any changes. Is my paranoia unjustified, or am I rightly noting that this is an encroachment on the principles that make GNU/Linux great?
So hang on, which cron tab does it put it in? I'm just looking up.
etc/cron.daily, he says. Have you got Chrome installed there, Ben?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, you were trying to buy your rugby tickets with it, yes.
Yeah.
I
at the very least, I think it should be clear that that's what the dev file does.
It also points out that when you're installing a .deb package from outside of your package repository, outside of your distro's repository, it can do anything. You know, it can do things running as root. And we all know that Linux is more intrinsically more secure than Windows due to its architecture and engineering and open source by and large. But, you know, if Linux had 50%, 80% market share and everybody was downloading and double clicking random deb packages, you know, we'd have all sorts of dodgy code out there.
Yeah. The plugin for Google Hangouts also does it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, he also followed up saying that you can add Pepper to Chromium to get Flash support. So that's another way to do it. But yeah. Anyway,
I think it's bad. I agree with him, and it's a really good find, a really good spot. I think they should tell you, and really, they should give you the option to not enable it.
It does seem quite sort of invasive, especially if you're really big on software freedom, yeah. You don't want these things poking around in your system. Thanks, Dizzy Lizzy. If anybody else wants their Vocons neuralized.
Hey, that's cool.
That's the new name of this section.
That's then the name of this podcast.
Then email mike@linuxvoice.com.
Which brings us, storming into the voice of the masses. We asked, what will Linux look like in 10 years? So, solar-powered hoverboards, giant underground cities on Mars, slightly less painful dentistry. But what about Linux? How do you think our operating system will look in 10 years? Will it be eye trackers, desktops, What's this? We'll be all be running on multi-terahertz dodeca-core Raspberry Pi Model 8. Will the tablet craze die out?
Let's hope so.
So, what does everybody think? Here's what Fithich says. 2015 will be the year of Linux on the fridge. Firefox version 793 will have problems with the ice compartment add-on. Meanwhile, Libre Kitchen runs really slowly. It needs 4 terabytes of RAM and the kitchen server only has 4.1 terabytes total, resulting in the waste disposal unit putting the bins out a day late. Thankfully, things will be much better on the entertainment front as Mr. Pertwee's System G has a really great video player, graphics editor and music player, though it still has problems with Pulse Audio. Best of all, that everybody reading FOSS software on their self-driving cars gets an insurance discount as Windows just crashes all the time. Badum-tish. So there's a silly response. Or is it? Shadow Firebird says, assuming we don't fall foul of software patents, DRM or forking wars, then the best I can imagine is that as Linux gets more popular and relevant, it will come under even more pressure than before from greedy corporations and well-meaning millionaires. Call me a pessimist, but one thing I know for sure is that you can't put the genie back in the floppy. Whatever happens, however sidelined and embattled our corner becomes, some of us will be using some sort of Libre Unix EOS because principles. Yeah. How about you soothsayers over there in my little hangouts window? What do you think?
I think there's a serious side to it in that it would be nice that the momentum that we've had with open source and open standards continues, and I think we're going to see more and more of a threat to those. I mean, as Ben was saying, we were talking to Corey yesterday, and one of the things we were talking about was, you know, the internet and DRM, something that he believes very passionately about, and it would be nice if we're able to stem the inevitable tide, perhaps, of DRM and of closed documents, and make things more and more open. That's where I'd and more accountable. That's what I'd like to see, rather than any kind of, well, in a technical way, I'd like to have like a fully immersive Oculus Rift KD desktop.
That sounds horrifying.
With wobbly windows,
like a nightmare.
It'll be vomits everywhere. That's
absolutely terrible. Yes, more nightmare scenarios. Ray Wood says that RMS will be ranting about the binary blob of his right temporal lobe as his GNU-herd chip is implanted. Everyone else got Linux implanted. We will all be upgraded. here's quite a strange one here. Not Sure says, I hardly see Raspberry Pi in the market after 2 years, and here is why. And then there's a link to the world's first $9 computer. Your question is brilliant, but in those grey times where the American and United Kingdom of America governments are heading towards total disaster, no democracy, no encryption, no free speech, no privacy, and the worst, something about an arms treaty control, if the UK votes with a yes to leave the EU, then expect your Kim Jong-un Prime Minister to rename England to North Korea too.
I don't know whether it's coincidence or whether it's the spies, but you keep dropping out, Andrew.
It must be the spies.
You keep having to mention.
All right, well, let's move on from that then, in that case.
Yes, I think that's all true. I think
it's all true.
Yeah, we're living in this Philip K. Dick dystopia.
David Cameron, if you're listening, I don't.
Ben just wants to buy his
tickets. Please let me travel still. Yeah, I just want my World Cup tickets.
Ben, in 10 years' time, Ben will still be waiting for his World Cup tickets.
Go on, Ben.
I think there's a couple of parts to this. Obviously, with computers, there's always the hardware and the software. I think on the hardware front, things aren't going to change as much in the next 10 years as they have in the past. We're hitting various technical limits. So I think the top end of computers isn't going to be dramatically different from the top end of computers now. But the bottom end will be significantly faster. So for a very, relatively small amount, I think you'll actually be able to buy a reasonably powerful computer. I think battery tech's going to have got a lot better, as will screen tech. So super portable laptops that are very light with great screens are likely to be decently priced. And with those, it's going to open up a lot more options for your super wobbly, windowy, KDE loveliness.
Awesome. Retina implants.
Yeah, I think the Internet of Things is actually going to be a thing. I don't think it's very rare.
Can we call it something else, like just 10 years in advance?
Internet of Things klaxon.
Network of Bits. The Network of Bits is going to be a thing, although perhaps not in the way everyone wants it to be. But you'll be able to, with your Banshee music player, you'll be able to change the what's it on your stereo. And that sort of thing. And there could be some really cool stuff with that. But in general, I think people are still going to be using roughly similar interfaces to they are today. We'll still be using, for the most part, mouse. And I think touchscreens aren't going to catch on computers. I think tablets are going to remain a thing, but they're going to be more niche. And that's my prediction.
I predict in 10 years, we'll go back to the way interfaces were in the early 2000s. Because all these super flat things where you don't know if something is a button or an icon or a label, and removal of text from interfaces, so you've just got strange, like, click the hamburger thing. It's all going bonkers, and I'm not just saying that in an old get off my lawn type of way, but I just find a lot of modern interfaces unusable. So I think at some point everybody realised, yeah, we had it good in the 2000s with actual clickable buttons and sensible menus and things. So, see you all in 10 years. Mark my words.
Well, Sultan of Swing, I think this is the post that I agree with most strongly. When it comes down to it, Linux is just the kernel controlling whatever electronic device it's installed on. So in 10 years' time, it would be nice to see a proliferation of Linux kernels in more devices. I hope the kernel will still be open source and that software freedom will have usurped its commercial oppressors. GNU Linux has been a really fine example of how well free software can be implemented in our present time. And my dream would be for GNU Linux to be the foundation of change in our digital future. Yes, this is pretty much what I think. We've seen... I mean, Linux has proliferated in the last 10 years, but it's been in the form of Android. It's been a sort of stealth takeover on phones and tablets, and I can see that continuing in car radios and fridges, although it was a silly point, a facetious point rather. I think if you're going to build a smart fridge that you could email from home to say, put the kettle on... you know, you would just use Linux as the operating system. Why wouldn't you?
I love your vision of a future house where your fridge also has a hob to cook your and boil your kettle as well.
It's the System D fridge that does everything.
Can I just point out that there is actually a fridge that runs Ubuntu? It's called the Chill Hub, and it was released a few weeks ago.
Wow! What does it do?
I'm just on the web page now. I heard about it because I was listening to the Ubuntu UK podcast and they were talking about it on there.
That's a fine podcast.
There are other podcasts.
No, there aren't.
No, okay.
Hang on, I have to relocate my microphone for this.
It's just a mad dream, but it was a mad dream about a really good podcast.
Yeah, this is risky because I'm looking at this on the same browser that I've got my Rugby World Cup ticket queue on.
Uh-oh.
The Chill Hub runs snappy Ubuntu core, command calls, blah blah blah. Smart, basically. Oh, it's got some USB ports, and you can buy an add-on for a milky weight milk jug sensor. Presumably, that's something that sees how much milk's in your milk jug.
So much of this stuff like this in the Internet of Things just makes me think like it's just gonna make people lazier. Yeah, it just removes
even lazier than we already are.
Yeah. So, oh, we're going, my fridge can order everything and have it delivered and I don't even need to walk to the shop anymore and actually interface.
That would be good. I hate grocery shopping. I hate it. I already get everything delivered online anyway.
We get our milk delivered by a milkman. Still get the glass bottles and everything. But it's such an annoying thing to try and work out how much milk you need. If this thing could just say, you need... Yeah, just order milk when I need it. So when I go down in the morning for my coffee, there is milk there.
I don't understand why that's annoying. I mean, how much working out does it take?
Well, I have to decide a week in advance whether or not I want to have cereal or toast for breakfast.
So the worst that happens is that you have an extra mug's worth of milk that you can drink.
Well, no, it can get out of hand. You can have like, because you always forget to cancel it, and you've got like, it's skimmed milk, so you can't even do anything interesting like make cheese with it. If you don't have it in coffee or cereal, it's nasty.
But what happens if like friends come round or something, largely unexpected, and they want a coffee and say, oh, sorry, I haven't got any milk because I've customised my algorithm so much.
That's exactly the problem. In fact, I bet you can link this up to your Google Calendar.
And Facebook, yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah. And can't Amazon deliver stuff within like 20 minutes now by drone?
Actually, that's true. A bottle of milk by drone delivery, that's the future.
That would be the dream. You could do it while you're cooking as well. You'd just be like, I'm going to make this recipe, click a button on your phone, and the ingredients can come. And it can see what you've got in the fridge, what you haven't got. Damn it, I'm getting an Ubuntu fridge.
How much are they?
How much? Hang on. Well, the milk jug sensor alone is $50.
Right, I think that gives an indication.
I think, how much milk would you have to waste for the investment to be worth $50? How much milk saved would pay for that jug?
It's not the waste, it's the annoyance. That's what gets me. Because you feel like you've let the world down if you pour away curdled milk. You're like, some cow had to live in miserable conditions and eat grass for me to pour this down the sink. And if you don't, then you have to have coffee with no milk in it. But to answer the question about the price, it's $1,000 retail, or you can pre-order for $800.
Wow, you can't afford not to have it.
Yeah. I've never bought a fridge. How much is a fridge regularly? I don't know.
I don't know, but maybe there'll be like forks, so you'll have like a mint fridge soon, and a fridge that runs XFCE that will be cheaper and lighter.
Right, I've got to go in 2 minutes.
Yes, okay. Everybody has. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
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 That will catch them by surprise.
At least it's not us all quitting.
Yeah. It's such a